I think that that was not the actually the song that I was thinking it was, because I was waiting for that like violin solo to come in.
Ah.
Anyways, well, you know, mistakes. Live radio, what can you do? This is Swan, and I'm here with Chris and Avery, and you're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. And thanks for giving us your Sunday afternoon. What else are you going to do? It's so gloomy outside. Yeah.
Not laundry.
Not laundry. That's the answer to so many questions.
Right?
Yeah. Not laundry.
Laundry, not laundry. Yeah, I'm going to go with not laundry.
So if you recall, Chris is my super hot boyfriend, and he is okay with that introduction, so we'll go with that. But he also knows a lot about film and books and is an aficionado and consumer both. And Avery, I forgot your Twitter handle. You saw Pirates of the Caribbean and you're hooked?
Yes.
Buruch.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's the if you find her on Twitter, that's what you'll learn. But also an avid aficionado and consumer of books and movies, and a maker. Both of you guys are makers of things as well. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And as promised, today we're talking about adaptations. And I love, I just have like the conversation relayed to me, but when we suggested it, you were like, ooh, can I talk about Hunger Games? So I like Hunger Games, and I also like it as an adaptation. So let's talk Hunger Games first.
Nice.
Yeah. Thoughts? Discuss.
Yeah. So I read them when I was in Rwanda as a Peace Corps volunteer. So any kind of media, like, I just consumed.
Wow.
And I read them, I think, within 2 days.
Yeah.
Which is pretty easy to do. But I remember by the third book, I just plowed through because I needed to know what happened. It was very grotesque. But as the subject matter goes, that's what you should expect. So when I saw the movie, the third movie in particular, or fourth movie, because they split them up, I liked what they did. It wasn't calming, obviously, with the monsters, the hybrid human animals, but it didn't freak me out as much as the
book.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Talking about, like, the things that end up scaring you. I plug my ears a lot of times during scary movies because it's the sound that, mm-hmm. like, gets to me, which is common, apparently. But,
yeah,
like, it's interesting that the visual isn't the thing that scares me. It's the noise.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I could have been prepared for it, and that's why.
Yeah, you're like, I know it's coming. Yeah. How are they going to do it? Yeah. That reminds me of Anaconda, which is not an adaptation, but I was so insistent that I wanted to watch it. And that's when my mom was like, well, just plug your ears during the scary parts. And I was like, that doesn't make sense. What is that going to do? And it was like, boom. Like, I could finish the movie all of a sudden.
Totally, though. Without the sound, it's not as scary at all.
And also, like, if you finish it, then the monster is dead. If you, like, leave in the middle, you're like, it's going to come get me. They didn't get it.
No. Yeah. People's emotions don't transfer as much, I think. Chris
is quiet. Chris doesn't want to talk about Hunger Games.
I don't mind talking about Hunger Games.
Did you read them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I read them and I saw the films. Do you think that those parts of the film were less scary because your imagination was more potent than whatever someone could put on screen?
Possibly, yeah. Also, it was very dreary where I was. It was raining, and I was holed up reading. I was avidly reading it. I was consumed by it, so very possible.
It's interesting because it got big, and I resisted reading it for a long time.
That's until the movie started. Potter.
Yeah, until the movie started coming out, and even then was like, I just like avoided both, and then I dove in, and a couple days, you know, finishing a book, and then the next one, and then the next one, and then watching the movies, and then I was like, this is actually good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it really sucked you in, sucked me in.
Yeah, I mean, that's the power of a good story is, like, whatever, even if it speaks to the masses, it also just, like, as an experience, it's something that you'll choose. And I'm curious, have you reread them?
No, I have not.
Yeah, I haven't really reread them since, but just that, like, experience of being like, yes, I have to know what's happening next.
That's what I did for Twilight. Yes, I read Twilight.
Me too.
You're off the show. You're both off the show.
Chris is taking over. Good thing his mic is on and we can just, you know, let's go get coffee.
But I do have an interesting bit. The first movie, apparently, it drew a lot of criticism. The Twilight one. This will be my last. I promise, Chris.
Okay.
It's an adaptation.
It is.
To be fair.
But there was a scene in the book where they're in the car, and I remember distinctly that the subject matter was then put into, like, this forced scene where he's jumping back and forth between the trees, and I like that because it's action-based. If it was in a car, there are definitely dramatic moments in cars in movies.
Well, did you guys see that movie with, oh, shucks. It was, like, the whole movie was him talking on the phone in a car.
Oh, yeah, Tom Hardy.
Yeah, Tom Hardy. What is it called?
Lock.
Lock.
Yes.
Anyways.
I didn't see it.
Not an adaptation, but hole in a car, I fell asleep. It was a lot. Anyways, but yeah, this can translate into or transition us into talking about creative decisions with interpretations, because to actually like do a book word for word, scene for scene, like true as you can, doesn't create very interesting movies. So like talking about the changes to translate something from being in someone's head and having like all this like readable information to just visual information, like talking about the things that work and the things that don't. Any things come to mind with that?
I do, but I'm gonna
take over,
defer to Chris here.
No one needs to defer to me on anything. I mean, at least as far as mass pop culture, a great case study is the Harry Potter films. So if you look at the first two, for example, both directed by Christopher Columbus, who also directed Home Alone, in fact.
Yeah.
Those films are packed with everything from the books. I mean, all like minor plot points and jokes, secondary or even tertiary characters. Like, they really do feel like the books on screen in a literal sense. However, they're not good films. They're like, they're bloated and there's like things just constantly grind to a halt. So, you know, while it seemed to like make fans happy from a like film standpoint, they're just poor. definitely lacking. And in contrast, like the third film, Harry Potter and Prisoner of Azkaban, directed by Alfonso Cuarón, he came in, he took a lot of creative liberties, he streamlined parts of the plot, he excised certain scenes, excised certain characters, he even, this was like the most infamous change, he like made characters wear casual clothing instead of the school uniforms because he thought that would better inform their teenage personalities. And a lot of people like took umbrage with this and didn't really like these choices, but on the whole, like, I think it's a lot better film because it's been truly adapted to the medium and still like maintains the themes of the book, but not every last literal thing that happened.
Good point.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah.
Did you have any thoughts about that?
Well, about Harry Potter, well, I told you before, I consume most of the books through audiobooks.
Mm, so. Which, if you haven't, do it.
Yeah.
I mean, Chris didn't like it, but
don't do it.
There's voices and they're just delightful, and you can like be walking around in the real world with your earbuds in listening to this like magical overlap.
It's really nice. Yeah. Yeah, you can kind of transport into it. But on the whole, visual versus so No Country for Old Men, I read that book and then I saw the movie and I thought there was no difference between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Which in my mind was kind of, it was well done.
It's a little disappointing.
Both of them, but yeah, I was looking for something different when I'm watching the movie.
What do you, like, in the case of No Country for Old Men, is there certain something you feel?
Maybe you like changes that would have made it different.
I understand. I think what they're going for is the tone, creating that tone of just desolation. And it's eerie, and they did set that up very well. But I guess what I was looking for was a little more action. So that's my personal interpretation.
That's fair. I was thinking on the ride over here about the things that the two that came to my mind are films and books that I appreciate because they were so different. And that is The Princess Bride and Stardust. And I feel like there's just enough different that I could like separate them into different things in my mind, but the story was still there and the mood, the tone was still like very present. But I feel like, and especially in the case of Little Princess Bride, that Buttercup was such a better character on film. She was just like more, I don't know, she was so ditzy and just like, but I'm beautiful in the book. And then on the film, she was like, I can sometimes do things. Like, can sometimes be okay. And yeah. I liked that as a experience. So
I'll have to read those too. I like both those movies. Stardust is my go-to.
Definitely.
Pick me up now. Yeah.
Super in love with it. And the book is just as enchanting. So enjoy that.
Pick that up. Yeah.
So do you think that, would you choose, if you want to expose someone to The Princess Bride, do you think you would choose
film
as primary text?
Yeah, because a lot of people do have issues with the book because of the Buttercup aspect, because they're feminists. And also, I liked this, but it can be a lot. It like begins with this long, long, long introduction of how this book is like an abridgment of this book that never existed. And all the troubles he went through to get this book that isn't a real book. And it's like the preface. So you're sitting here reading this and like, okay. And so I tell people to skip that. Just skip to the story. The book is witty. It has, you know, it has more in it than the movie did. Like The Pit of Despair or whatever, where Wesley's taken at the end. I should have like tagged this with like spoiler alerts, like don't listen unless you've seen and read everything. Just kidding. But at the end, it just goes into more detail about how it had different levels and different animals that Prince Humperdinck would then like go and kill, and that was his huge hobby, and that's why he was such a like a scary person in the book, because like his pastime was literally hunting all of the apex predators that he could find, and so Wesley was like the ultimate like thing for him to defeat.
Okay, so. Backstory. That's good. Yeah, because he comes across as kind of comical.
Yeah, but and it is funny too in the book because I can't think of the author. Ugh, it's escaping me. Names. Anyways, he's like, so yeah, in the abridgment, it goes on for about 40 pages talking about dresses. And so like he's like holding on to this, like, I'm abridging this book throughout the whole book still. And it's just kind of like this comical thing that I think it's timed well. It's not like obnoxious at any point, but you're just like, he's editing a book that doesn't exist, and now he's reminding us that it's like, and then it goes on and on about the wedding preparations and like this. Just laughing.
Right.
On it's a farcical. Separate note.
Yeah. It's like that song, the greatest song that was ever written.
Then I forgot to write it down, and now it doesn't exist. Yeah. So you'll just have to trust me that it was the greatest song, and I did sing it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. But it's just like that's a good device for comedy and can be for drama as well.
Yeah, but like that wouldn't have been fun in the movie. Yeah. So they kind of like made it a much smaller part.
Right. So in the book, there's no grandfather talking to his sick nephew.
It is grandson. The book that his grandfather supposedly told him. Oh. And when his son was sick, he wanted to find this book to read to him. And he went through all these troubles to find this book that he supposedly then found, but he didn't because it doesn't actually exist. Mm. And then he tells a story of his son hating it, and then he tries to read it, and it's not how he remembered it, and he realized that his grandfather couldn't read, but that he was just, like, reciting the good parts from his memory from when his, like, father would read it to him. I don't know.
Okay, but there's, yeah, so... flipping. Yeah, it's creating the story on the go.
So in the film, they just, like, summarized it back to, like, grandfather reading to son.
Right, yeah.
Or
distilling it. Yeah. Yeah. Digestible.
So it sounds like, Swan, you're okay with things getting excised as long as the film maintains the same themes and tone of the book.
Well, I think so. I'm trying to think about a time that I've been upset by a film. My father was like, you have to read the book first. So inevitably, I always liked the books more because I think whichever one you consume first, you like more. And that was really displayed in my life when I saw The Count of Monte Cristo, which was a lovely movie. And then I read the book and it was like really dark and gory. Like the movie was had that like revenge that was really dark, but the book was just like,
epic.
I was disturbed, and then it ends so differently, and I was like, how do you consolidate this? And I was like, not a fan of the book. And that like circumstance, I liked the movie more because I saw it first, so I wanted that.
There's been different versions of the movie, right? Different.
Yeah. The newest one is the one that I was exposed to first.
I didn't see it, but I did read the book. And yeah, it does take you on a long ride.
Yeah. He's so descriptive of these, like, it's like a visceral experience reading about the things that he's doing anyways.
Right.
You're just like, ooh.
Yeah, I think that might have turned me off to watching the movie because I didn't think it would have the same kind of impact on me, the same kind of effect that reading it did. So,
Avery, are there any film adaptations of books where something was, you felt like something was left out, even if the tone and themes of the book remained,
like major things,
something that bothered you?
Well, something that bothered me but wasn't left out was actually added in. I recently just watched the Laurence Olivier version of Pride and Prejudice, and at the end, so his aunt, this might also be a spoiler alert,
I've never read it or seen it.
All right, I'll try to just skim. But they change a major character's attitude almost from the book. And it, I think it does a disservice to the story. But it was Hollywood. It actually really was Hollywood taking over the theme of it. Yeah. And then changing a character's motives and her overall personality. Just to kind of make it happy.
Like something that was maybe merely suggested?
No, it's pretty descriptive, like who this person is. She's bitter and she has all this power, but she's not happy. Mm-hmm. And so she takes it out on people. But towards the end, she's, in this movie at least, in this adaptation, it's just, oh, ha ha ha, chummy, I'm on your side now. You can do whatever you want.
And you're like, wait.
It was funny. I was watching it. I was like, this is so, it just veered off into some kind of like candy lollipop land. Like, no.
So it wasn't coherent in the, if you hadn't read the book and you just watched the film, it still wouldn't have made sense.
Was it a drastic change for her film?
Yeah, like
presence?
within the context of the film itself, did it make sense?
Standing alone. It's not a complete turnaround, but it is noticeable, and people, I don't think, make that switch so drastically. Perhaps they do, but then it's a different story. She's a different character in it.
Yeah.
So kind of tacked on then.
Yeah. Yeah. So now you have to go watch it.
I mean, you didn't exactly sell it.
It has its other kind of up moments, though. Well, anyway, that's a classic, though, Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah,
so.
It is. Yeah, it's one of those, more consumed by women than by men.
Perhaps,
hands
down.
Yeah. It was interesting. I watched a play in Utah once where he derived a lot of his influences from Emily Bronte and
Charlotte.
Yes.
Right.
Charlotte. Charlotte Bronte and Jane Austen.
Yes.
And it was the first time that I've ever like heard a man wax poetic about these things that usually women are like, oh, swoon, and guys are like, why?
Yeah.
He was just like, the language is so beautiful and like the themes that they dealt with are really complex with the times, and I was just like, okay, this guy, it's interesting. But I feel like it could be safely said that most men aren't actively,
unless they're English majors or literature buffs. Yeah.
Yes. So we started the show with a impromptu writing thing. And after some juggling of words and ideas, settled on the prompt of like the movie that you watched again and again as a child. So I was just going to give you guys the moment to read or summarize what you wrote earlier.
Do you want to go first, Avery, or should I?
You can go first.
Okay. Let's see. I put where I wrote it down. Oh, yeah, here we go. My go-to film was always the original Star Wars. My parents showed it to me when I was six. I was hooked. Something about the pure escapism of it was eternally entertaining, but I really loved feeling the sense of destiny and purpose, that anyone could go from a life of dead and boredom to saving the galaxy.
Nice.
Thank you, Avery.
So mine was Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which now thinking back was kind of advanced for me because now I can't even watch it. And that lies in the fact that the one scene where, again, spoiler alert, but it's graphic and it's torture-based, which I don't really take well anymore. But the interplay of animation and live action was, even in itself, kind of advanced for that time. I think it came out the year I was born. Huh, so maybe that's why I have an affinity towards it. But
sold.
Did you choose to watch it, or was like someone else watching it and you just happened...
You know, my parents probably watched it, and then they deemed it appropriate for me at the age of six.
I know. So. I watched so many rated R movies as a kid. Like, I watched Hannibal or Silence of the Lambs when it came out, and my dad was watching it, and I was like, why am I,
okay.
Should not be okay.
That's darker than this Rabbit.
Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, but it's true. The choices that parents make, they're like, and then that affects you for life. Like Jaws.
It's funny you bring up Jaws because that's actually an adaptation.
Mm-hmm. Based on a book?
Yeah. Mm. But the funny thing is it's the novel's terrible, but it's just a great concept, you know, like a shark terrorizing like this small New England town on the coast.
Yeah.
And there's actually, I don't know, at least in my own like reading and film watching experience, there's a lot of terrible novels that make for great films. The Godfather being another one, where it's like it's poorly written, but there's some great ideas there. And so, you know, if you as a screenwriter, if you can take those ideas and then bring them into a visual medium, like, and then if it's a bad novel, I feel like it's even easier because you can strip away everything because no one's going to be attached to the prose.
Just hold on to like the handful of good things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they take the concepts at work and then kind of change maybe the tone or the whole aesthetic to it. So
I find it interesting that none of us wrote about adaptations because Star Wars wasn't an adaptation.
I thought about writing about Jaws for records,
just for the sake
of that would be like number two after Star Wars. Mm. But I was like,
I want to read this because I can. It's my show. Okay, I think about what film I watched over and over, and the only thing that comes to mind is my sister and her obsession with George the Jungle. She watched it every day for months and still laughed at the funny parts and was afraid at the scary parts and swooned at the end. It was memorable to me because it was the one thing she didn't care if I teased her about it. She loved it and without apology. Every time it was her turn to pick a movie, it was always George. That's all.
Nice.
So shout out to my sister and like her like shameless like affection for this movie that was pretty goofy.
Yeah, I remember seeing that in theaters, actually.
Being like, what? Okay. I saw it.
Yeah, not particularly memorable.
But it's the connection, though, to people like who introduce you to these movies, too, that kind of lingers.
Yeah,
the people
I mean,
you watch them with.
Totally. The movies get fused with relationships and experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
like my cousin who I watched Jaws with. I don't know why she let me watch it because I was visibly shaking.
But, yeah. It's like me and Anaconda, and my mom's like, just plug ears. I'm like, why are we even here?
Like, I know what we're watching tonight, though.
Oh, dear. Well, that makes me think of censorship because in my mind, like, I would never, I worked at a school and I was never like censoring what people were reading, but I would actively censor what people watched. You know, when The Dark Knight came out, I would see the boys get really violent if we watched it. So I'd always be like, nope, we're not watching that. Here's three other options. Pick one. So it's interesting like, we obviously didn't have censorship, but for you, is there a difference between allowing someone to read something at a young age versus allowing someone to watch something at a young age?
No, probably not when it comes to the content. I mean, at the end, that's like what, and yeah. And people do have, like you were explaining before, with a visceral reaction. Like, you can really, you can feel those things and being written. Everybody's different, obviously, but
yeah. I think about great authors who talk about consuming books way above their maturity level as children, and so
might have informed their
Like, maybe it was just like pushing them to start having mature thoughts earlier. I don't know.
Depending on twisted thoughts.
Yeah, well, thoughts. people respond a lot more strongly to visual imagery. I mean, the best examples is, so like, if you look at the news, you know, it's not the things that are even, or just even if you look, go online, like social media, people aren't sharing text. I mean, they share some text, but that's
images.
Yeah. You know, it's like that, you know, there was an image of a Syrian boy like washed up on the beach, like that more than any article about the Syrian civil war
was created conversation.
Yeah. So I feel like as far as censorship goes, it can be, you know, as far as like showing a kid an adult film or adult film with a more mature content versus reading something, like those images could really stick with them, potentially in a negative way, versus I feel like, I mean, obviously the written word can have extremely powerful effects, but I feel like there's also more of a space to take it in and interpret it and make it your own.
I think about the films that shaped me. George Lucas was huge with like Willow, and just like things that kids haven't even watched or heard of now, like Princess Bride. Even like teenagers now probably like just as soon haven't seen it than they have. So it's interesting, I guess, like there aren't classic films in the way that there are like quote-unquote classic novels that just like stand true to the test of time, but there are. And this is something we were talking about before the show. It's just like this priority given to books is like a greater art form perhaps than film, despite the amount of money and effort that are actively being poured into the film industry. It's like,
yeah,
interesting to think about. I was just, I'm talking too much maybe, but
no, there's one piece that I read. It's like one of the like first major article about film adaptation by Andre Bazin. And one of the great points he makes is that like stories, like verbal written stories, have always been adapted into visual art forms. Like, he gives the example of like biblical stories and Greek and Roman myths were adapted into paintings and sculptures and whatnot. And so like, film is just the most recent visual medium that with which we are adapting
to tell stories.
Yeah. And so naturally we're adapting you know, word-based texts into that. So I just feel like cinema is just another art form, no greater or lesser than anything that's come before or anything that's coming in the future, and so we should treat it seriously and treat film adaptations of books seriously, and not just as like, oh, well, it's not like the book, so I don't care.
Like, well, independently of the book.
Yeah.
That's
just like, begs the question of, is it more transient because our culture is so like consume on to the next thing? I mean, are there classics that are films that are being made now that are still going to be consumed by significant portions of the population in 20 years or 100 years?
Yeah, I mean, there's great films coming out all the time.
From the person that sees all of them.
Someone's got to watch them. I think, you know, as like culturally, Americans and the world as a whole has become like more and more segmented, as because the internet has sort of allowed for these sub-alternative cultural spheres where there no longer needs to be a mainstream that everyone has to adhere to. So it's a lot harder to have this to have works, whether novels or films or whatnot, that are truly reaching and connecting with everyone. Mm-hmm. But that being said, like, I feel like there are definitely films coming out that the majority of the American population does end up seeing and talking about. I mean, one thing that comes to mind is, you know, a couple years ago, you had Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, technically an adaptation of comic book.
Mm-hmm.
And that was both a critical and popular hit, and spoke a lot to American values at the moment, especially like this post 9/11 fear and paranoia. And so I feel like when a text works like that, it will definitely be watched much later. Plus, it's very entertaining. So
I feel
like yeah, I feel like it has everything you want.
Similar to that, it's probably The Shining. Stands on its own, but that was also an adaptation.
And his Stephen King's least favorite, according to...
Oh, yeah. Well, I had to force myself to watch it because I don't really like horror.
Well, we were talking about, I feel like we keep saying, like, you have to see them as separate things mm-hmm. in order to, like, be, to not, they're not comparable,
mm-hmm.
Because, like, one is one experience and another is another experience. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about Ray Bradbury, and I read him, his last lectures, and he's talking a lot about how he loves the adaptations of his books, but that it's all rooted in good writing. If you have a good screenwriter, you're going to have a good film. If you like, and he, you know, he talks about how you have to change elements of the story because they are different. One is a written interaction where you're engaging with a reader, and one is like a visual audio thing that you're engaging. So obviously different elements have to be emphasized in order to create a good story, a good experience. So that's something that I was appreciating as just thinking about adaptations of, like, they are different experiences, so you have to see them as such. And it comes back to the story, it comes back to the elements that resonate with people.
Yeah, I think the most interesting film adaptations are ones that really just use the original book as a launching point for something entirely different.
More inspired by?
Yeah, I mean, so one of my favorite examples of that would be Where the Wild Things Are, which is like, I mean, so it's originally just this book by Marie Sendak, and it's kind of this fun story as kid goes off.
It's a bedtime story.
Yeah, he goes and plays with these friendly monsters. They have fun. You know, he comes back. It's all good. Then a couple years ago, I think it was 2009, I want to say, Spike Jonze adapted it into a feature film. And it went from this light bedtime story into this, like, really serious take on loneliness and melancholy. And it's an incredible work, but it's not, you know, That original text is a children's book, and this is not a children's film by any means. Like, this is a film for adults.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, and talking back to censorship, I think there are, like, children screaming in the background. There's this, like, experience of the human condition, this, like, you know, being angry, being in love, being lonely, versus like these films that are and books that are like portraying content that's like more malicious in nature. But isn't it all just like different aspects of being human?
Yes. Well, that just reminded me of the Grimm's fairy tales were really dark. Ooh. And then it's the reverse Disney. Of Where the Wild Things Are. Yeah,
because talking about adaptations, this came up last night.
Yeah, there's a whole slew of that. We could talk ad nauseum. But, yeah, they were really... Those themes were not for kids. I mean, well, everything's for kids, I guess, if you want
But
to
they were really dark,
that.
And there was always, like, don't do this, or you'll, like...
Yeah.
Brutal consequences.
Yeah. Right. They had severe morality attached to them.
But then it comes back to, like, symbolism. To like mm-hmm. Red shoes symbolizing like losing virginity and like so literally like chopping off your shoes and creating these like experiences to fit your foot inside this glass slipper, just like all these things are like archetypes and symbols, and we can, you know, that's a different wormhole we could dive into, but
but kids these days, they don't even know Disney that much anymore.
It's all Pixar.
Yeah. Which also is made for adults. You have all those subtle, you know, tongue-in-cheek jokes, but ostensibly they're for kids.
They're for everyone of all ages.
Mm-hmm.
All ages.
Adult kids,
too. The show has been brought to you by Pixar.
Pixar wants to sponsor us. Finding Dory is funny. I feel like it... And then this happened. And then this happened. And then just when you think, nope, this happens.
The world. Yeah, I liked it better than Finding Nemo.
Really? You liked it better?
I did, yeah.
I liked Finding Nemo better, hands down. Because it seemed much more like... I just felt like at the end of Finding Dory, it was like, nothing's going right ever, 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 and it will never be okay. And like, I was just like obstacle and obstacle and obstacle and obstacle. And at a certain point, I was just like so stressed out for the characters. I was like, ugh.
That kind of resonated with me though. Maybe that's just a reflection on my own life. But yeah, like it's chaotic. All right, deal with it.
I know we're. I don't know the extent of it, but we're both pretty eclectic individuals. And I was like, Chris, what should I say for her like little blurb? And he's just like, how do you summarize Avery?
That's pretty true. I'm interested in documentaries, but then I love comedies. So you've got really serious subject matter and then slapstick. I love slapstick.
Nice. Yeah. It makes me curious, is there any documentaries inspired by books? I haven't.
Food Inc.
Food Inc.
That's the first one that comes to mind.
Research this, and I haven't seen that or read the book, which is funny.
Wasn't Fast Food Nation also?
Oh,
I think that one. Yeah. Was also based on the book.
Yeah,
I'm sure based on the book. And like maybe the food industry that's more like.
Yeah.
Talking about translating ideas, because then you have a book that's like dealing with this issue, and you're not actually like going back and creating experiences. You're like delving more into mm-hmm. that same issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it can get a lot thornier, especially if you're adapting a nonfiction book into a fictional film, because then it stops becoming a question of, you know, erasing the literary author's intent and whatnot, and like actually, you know, you're changing facts, things that literally happened, and so. Especially if this is a fictional film that features some kind of message, you know, whether it's dealing with the food industry or whatnot, then, like, is that getting diluted by being turned into this, you know, factual book, into this entertainment?
Mm-hmm. The sensationalism of it, yeah.
So Food Inc. was fiction?
No, Food Inc., that was
documentary.
Okay,
just checking in, because
Yeah.
So maybe you mean maybe, like, an autobiography? Or a biography of somebody that turns into some kind of fiction film?
Yes. So, I mean, at least recent example I can think of is Team of Rivals, which was a book about Abraham Lincoln, nonfiction book, was adapted into Steven Spielberg's Lincoln a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
I've seen this book because my dad's really into reading those kinds of books, and like that thing is a tome.
Mm.
I mean, you could kill someone if you hit them over the head with it.
Mm.
So it was interesting in the film to sort of see how it's pared down, because I feel like that's even more difficult with a thick nonfiction book.
Yeah, if you're working with so much content, how do you pull out the parts that matter?
The dramatic parts too. How do you create the
drama?
Well,
that's how do you create
it?
Drama?
Yeah.
I mean, that was one that I thought was one of the great gifts of that film was that. I mean, it's all conversations. It's really like Lincoln talking to all these different politicians, basically, and like trying to get
fascinating.
This. Yeah, let's say it's like politics on screen, but it's made dramatically compelling. And that's, I mean, that's extremely difficult.
Accomplishment.
Yeah, it's a real accomplishment. Yeah.
Wasn't 12 Angry Men kind of all set in the same space? I actually never saw it, but it was
yeah.
all conversations.
Yeah, there's two versions.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was an adaptation of a play, so
right.
it's like a little easier because it was always intended to be seen.
Mm-hmm. True. Yeah. Wait, wasn't the... Sorry.
No, what were you going to say?
I was thinking about this, the movie that just came out. There's both a documentary and the narrative, and it was about the boxer, that whole kerfuffle with him. And he was killed by his manager. What was it called?
Oh, Foxcatcher.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting because you have... you have this fictional film, and then you have this documentary. So on one hand, the documentary you think would take primacy, but it actually... So, I mean, that story is about these two wrestling brothers and their relationship with DuPont, who's this, like, crazy millionaire. Mm. The documentary, if you watch it, you can't figure out that wrestler had a brother.
Oh.
Even though, like, his... Versus, like, in the fictional film, like, their relationship is primary. Mm. So it's a weird... So, I mean, documentaries can get iffy, too.
It's like the content you choose to put together versus what you leave out.
Well, I don't like them calling it, like, non-narrative. Like, narrative versus documentary. Because documentaries are narrative. They are
They have to be. I think stories speak to people. If there's not a story, they're like, we just watched Shark Water. Wait, what is it called?
Yeah, Shark Water.
And, like, dealing with really pressing, like, things and, like, this is happening and, like, yeah, we're helping, but also, like, this is still really a big deal. And at the end of it, I was left wanting. Mm. And I was like, that's frustrating because I care mm-hmm. already, but if I was only exposed to this, then I probably wouldn't care.
Hmm. Okay, so it was too dry, maybe?
Well, it just was, like, not... It was put to... I mean, Chris could probably speak to it with more more better words, but for me it was like just left something to be desired in the fact that, like, okay, here's this story, but then it became about him, but it was never really about him, the filmmaker. And so when it became about him, I lost interest. And then at the end he was like, yay, we won this major battle, but it didn't feel like a win.
Hmm. Yeah, there's no real third act if you're gonna look at it from a typical narrative structure.
Got it.
And then, yeah, as Swan said, like, it...
There's, like, no motivation to action either, which is, as a filmmaker, making something, I feel like that's your primary objective, is, like, I want to give voice to this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Like, do not resist the documentary out now about, it was at Tribeca, and it's out now, and it's being played about police brutality. Well, not police brutality, but, like, overstepping.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, sorry. I was okaying in my mind because I had... This is Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. Thank you for listening. Also, the Bushwick Film Festival is happening this weekend, and I wanted to mention, so go check out things if you're free, and it's great weather for movies, so... Mm-hmm. What were you going to say, Chris, about Sharkwater, maybe? Or just about third acts, narratives...
Nothing.
Okay.
Well, I mean, we can switch tracks here, though. So we've been, you know, primarily talking about books being adapted into film, but there's also, I mean, a lot lesser, but there's also films that are turned into books, i.e. novelizations. Mm. So we have, Swan and I were talking a little bit about this on the subway, so we're kind of curious, Avery, if you had any thoughts about novelizations.
I'm trying to think of a few.
Take your time.
It might be a while, though.
We're just here.
If you have any, though.
We'll just stare. Well, I think it's an interesting idea, but I feel like as a creative person with, I have outlets, I feel like I never quite know where inspiration comes from, but to actively watch a film and be so inspired by it that you want to, like, write that story is an interesting idea, because Chris's criticism of that is that it's just like reading the film. There's not you have this opportunity to create depth, to like get into people's heads, to see motivations in a different way, to create a different experience. And I feel like that while that is a great opportunity, you get curtailed by people who are involved in the film saying, wait, what are you doing?
Right, rights come into play.
Yeah, well, that's the big issue is that novelizations aren't begun ever as a creative endeavor. They're begun purely as a tie-in to the film.
Capitalism.
Yeah, versus, you know, there are plenty of film adaptations of books that are don't, I mean, obviously you have your Hunger Games adaptations and whatnot, but like there are plenty of film adaptations to start because there is a screenwriter or a director who's interested in how this work could come to the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And novelizations never work like that.
Well, fan fiction. I'm thinking of that.
Yeah, that's just true.
Yeah. There's, I mean...
Right, there's all these spin-offs and like with, you know, the movie would spawn some other version, kind of different characters.
And I think of the Harry Potter Alliance, you know, these books and films inspiring a group of adolescent kids to like actually be activists and create change with one another. It was just like, whoa, how did that come from that? But it's great.
That's cool. Yeah. Well, that's the hope, is right. It inspires good and not bad, like Dark Knight Rises. Whoops, womp womp, sorry. But I'm trying to think of a movie into a book, though. I think there is one that I know I might have even
read. I was trying to think about it, too, because I felt like, you know, as creative mediums, like...
Sorry, I'm on the
spot. That's
okay. No, did you see how many times I can't remember names? I'm like, pretty much, like, I can't... People are like, your show's great. And I'm like, oh, because I mispronounced everyone's name and I couldn't remember that book that I was trying to think of. I was just like, ugh. Like, surprise, I'm human.
It's charming, though, right?
Yeah. Yeah, people are still listening. Thanks, guys. You're great.
Yeah.
We can always switch tracks again.
Okay. MC.
Thanks. You're such a great co-host, creating pacing.
Yeah. Another thing that I was thinking about, Avery, was that so the traditional medium or traditional context within to experience a film was a theater, right? So you bought your ticket, you went to the theater, you experienced it in one go. You had no control over, you know, it started and then it ended, right? And that was it and you left.
Right.
Versus ever since DVDs came around, films have suddenly become texts that are more similar to books because you can start and stop whenever you want. And even on, if you look at DVDs and Blu-rays, like they're organized into chapters, you know, so a very literary frame. So I was just kind of curious, you know, do you feel like that's changed how we experience films? Do you feel like that makes us experience films more like books, or are they such different mediums that not really?
For me personally, it has changed as I came about in the time of VHS.
Wait, then, no, a Laserdisc? Come on.
Maha! And so when DVDs came out, it wasn't so much the start and stop and, you know, rewind forward, but it was the behind-the-scenes materials that got me so that I could learn the creative process because sometimes the directors, writers, stars would sit down and talk about it, which I found fascinating. So maybe that colors your absorption, your conception of the story and the elements of it. And now being interested in film editing, I even notice in TV, but also movies, different editing choices, cuts. And I pause it and I go back just to study it because I'm like that.
Yeah, it's great to learn. But you make a good point about the behind the scenes documentaries and commentaries and whatnot. And that, to me, also makes films acting more like books because if you say you pick up, like, a collected works of William Shakespeare, like, you have an introduction, you have annotations, you know, you might have appendices, you know, you have all these additional texts not created by the author, right? And since the rise of DVDs and Blu-rays, you have these same things. You have, you know, you might have behind-the-scenes documentaries, you might have commentary. But a lot of times there's additional content about the film that's not produced by the same creative forces that created the film.
Yeah, exactly.
So it becomes sort of this like multi-layered text with multiple voices chiming in.
Right.
We were also discussing, it's kind of interesting that the creative people, you already said this, I was trying to look up who actually takes a film and cuts it up into chapters because it's not the people who are on that crew. It's like the DVD publisher, maybe. You were saying that. I was trying to find it on Google, and I guess I'm not searching the right things. I just keep coming up with, like, how to create your own, like, DVD chapters, but it's more for, like, home video stuff. So,
well, it's the distributor, most likely.
Yeah, the distributor.
I don't know exactly the title of that person who does it, but Yeah, I think once they buy the and they take which, over the film, like that's what they are in charge of.
Which for me was an interesting question because there's something about like organizing brains that are creating that structure of like, here's a thing, here's the all the other things, and like this thing is broken apart in these like breaths or these like things.
Mm-hmm. That's true, because if you go back and watch a really good movie and you want to see that particular scene and you can fast
find
forward
it.
Right, but it's according to whoever decided that breaking point, that cutoff point.
Yeah,
it's not really it's mostly
which transitions to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a very logical organization. We're like, okay, well, the film's this length, so we should probably chop it up into this many parts.
Ish. But like, some of them do it literally by timestamps, and others do it by like, this happened, and then this is this part, and this is this part.
Mm.
Yeah, but they don't. I don't know. I sort of feel like if directors or editors would put in charge of those. Chapters that they might make very different choices.
Well, I mean, some people in the, I think of Ray Bradbury again because I just read his book, but he's just like, no, that's not, that content has nothing to do with this thing because this is the thing that I made.
Hmm.
And he talked about that in the context of film with people doing commentaries and special features, and he was like, nope, not on my, like,
he's a purist.
He's just like, yeah, which I kind of appreciate because it simplifies it in some ways.
Right.
But fans want more.
Yeah.
So we give them more.
Well, I mean, at least in my case, part of it is, yeah, it's just nice to, like, learn more about the world of the film. But sort of as Avery mentioned, like, it's as someone who produces visual content, it's great to just learn more about these works and, like, how they literally were made.
Mm-hmm.
Both from, like, how did your ideas come about to, like, what was your process to bring them onto the screen, you know, and just the various creative choices that they made throughout? Because, that's extraordinarily informative. And a lot of times they're informative in a way that a traditional education might not be.
Right. Yeah. Deleted scenes. Why'd you cut it? I want to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's huge for whether
it can change a story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Way big. We're actually running close to the end of our show. And I like to end with a series of rapid-fire questions. So these are more related to books, but I'll start with the one that's more related to film. What is your current Netflix addiction? Or any, like Hulu, whatever, Amazon.
Oh, I got this. Jane the Virgin.
Oh, yes. So great.
Talking about, you know, writing and that literary force and using TV as the medium to express it. Woo! It's so entertaining, too.
It's pretty fun to watch. What are you, first season, second season?
Second season. Oh, trying to race through, too.
Yeah, I typically wait till, like, it's all out. So I have, like, I can always go on to the next. When I get to the end of a season, I'm like, what happens now? Like, I'm trapped in this space where I just have to wait. I hate waiting.
Yeah.
Chris, do you have a current Netflix addiction?
No, I don't think so.
Mine's the classic Bob's Burgers and nature documentaries.
Yes, Bob's Burgers, yeah. That and BoJack Horseman are my go-to when I'm not interested. Like, I want to laugh, but I don't want to get too invested.
Yeah, you can just, like,
yeah,
side participation. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if there's any writers that have influenced you and your, like, processes as a filmmaker and a creative person.
Other than Jane Austen?
Yeah.
Writers. Oof.
Or films, we can't, like,
yeah, or directors.
Directors or authors.
I'm going to get her name wrong, but she is a director. I think her name's, she's coming out with something now.
Give me movies and I'll give you names.
Yeah. Monsoon Wedding, have you heard of it?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
geez, it's a great storytelling format, basically. It's very fluid. It deals with a family.
Miranair?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, Miranair.
Yeah.
Thanks, Google.
Yeah, and I think she's directed something out now, actually produced by Disney, so, you know.
I never saw Monsoon Wedding.
It's really fabulous.
Let's watch it.
Yeah. Have you seen it?
Nope, but it's not been on the list for a while.
I got into Bollywood films a while ago, and the one that, like, stuck with me the hardest was Lagan. Did you see that?
No.
Oh, it's so good.
I can't believe you've seen Lagan.
Why? I can't believe... everyone hasn't seen Lagan. It's so good. It's long, though.
Yeah, also, it's a four-hour film about cricket. You know, it's hard. It's kind of
but
a hard sell.
It's so good. It's so intense.
And it's Bollywood, though, like traditional Bollywood?
There's not really dancing, which I think is why it resonated more with me, because that gets cheesy sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, I got into it, and I liked a lot of the films that I saw with those dynamics, but this one was more like drama.
Yeah, Monsoon Wedding is definitely not the traditional Bollywood, like break out into dance and
great
song.
I love how Chris's response to movie hasn't seems like, let's watch it.
Obviously.
Yeah, no, you should.
Watch all the movies, read all the books. So say you're at a party, what's your favorite brag? So like you like in a group of people, and I always say like I'm the queen of eclectic living because I have an interesting set of houses in my background. Self-imposed.
That you carry them around with you wherever you go.
Yeah.
I like that. Nice image. It's not really bragging, but I slipped on a banana peel once.
Actually slipped on a banana peel?
Yep.
Was it like a
whoop? Like in a some kind of cafeteria?
It was outside, and we were in a group, and I was out on the outskirts of the group, and I just kind of backed up, and then I did a woo! And everybody looked, and then they looked down at the ground, and it was a very, like, yeah, cinematic moment. Like,
was there a laugh track?
Dude, did you really? Yeah, I was the laugh track.
Chris, do you have a favorite brag?
You know my favorite brag.
Your mile?
Maybe.
Okay, what's your favorite brag right now in this moment?
Oh, I mean, usually I just say that I can run a sub-5-minute mile.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I can't do that.
I think my best time was 6:56 or something. That was middle school.
I know. Like, in school, I was always, like, the 10-minute-er that was just like, meh, are we done yet?
More like a walk, yeah.
Well, thanks so much for listening. We're actually out of time, but I'm so glad you were here. Thanks, Avery and Chris. This is Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. If you missed any part of this, catch the podcast. We're on all the things, Stitcher, iTunes, Audio Boom, and we're on all the socials, so let's be friends. And I'll leave you with a word, take it or leave it. I forgot my word. Huh? Ambed.